Branford Marcellus, David Sanborn, Kenny Barron, Miguel Zenon, James Francis, and Kenny Garrett. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on audio, then podcast, and then scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're listening to music by Dave Iwataki. Today I feature two Japanese-American artists whose work includes activism in Portland. They are currently in the upcoming production of The Journal of Ben Uchida at Oregon Children's Theater. We go behind the scenes to profile actor and poet Ken Yoshikawa and actress and radio producer Jenna Yokoyama. Hear how they've used their artistic talents to bring awareness about the imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II and about their local involvement in Tsuru for Solidarity, a national art project and detention sites and support frontline immigrant and refugee communities that are being targeted by racist, inhumane immigration policies. We'll also hear poems from Ken's new book, Monster Colored Glasses. So stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio. With me on location at Oregon Children's Theater's actor and poet Ken Yoshikawa. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
And with him is actress and KBOO's interim co-station manager, is that correct? Mm-hmm. Jenna Yokoyama.
Hello.
It's good to talk to you both on Stage and Studio. And so, just as some background, we're all working together here at OCT on a play about Japanese-American incarceration during World War II. It's called The Journal of Ben Uchida, and Ken plays the title character, and Jenna is Naomi, his sister. And that show's about to open on February 29th and runs through March 22nd, and you can find out more about that at octc.org. However, what I want to talk about is actually the issues of the time period. We just had the Day of Remembrance, and that was on February 19th, in which Day of Remembrance is the 78th anniversary of that, and in which FDR made the Executive Order 9066, which actually legalized the forced imprisonment of Japanese Americans into American concentration camps. And that's the actual term that FDR wanted to originally use. It was deemed as too harsh, and it was changed to internment camps. However, there's a movement about that. Jenna, you want to talk about like the getting rid of the euphemisms?
Yeah, it's actually, I find it really interesting that we have used the word internment camps, because internment is something very, very specific. Internment camps are places where you place people who are aliens into camps. So it's much more accurate to say concentration camps. And I understand why people have wanted to move away from the term in terms of showing respect for other concentration camps that have existed. And oftentimes when we use that term concentration camp, it brings up the imagery and the history of the Jewish Holocaust. And so I see how people have not wanted to possibly use that term, but it's time, and I think it's been time for, well, 78 years now, that we acknowledge that a concentration camp is something very specific. It's when you concentrate citizens, where you put people together, and those can become killing camps. And that was the horror of the Holocaust. But it's to say that Japanese Americans went into concentration camps is actually what is accurate. And we need to make sure that we're using the terms that are accurate so that we're not stuck in a land of euphemisms, so that we are not looking back and saying, well, this history was okay, that it was something that was gentler than it actually was, because it was actually something that was very traumatic and pretty, you know, terrifying for those who were involved in it.
And I liked how you explained that. And actually, I was at a talk back after the Minidoka film, and some of the survivors said that some of the Jewish Holocaust survivors actually want not to have the euphemism of concentration camps, but calling it what it was, death camps, mm-hmm. right? Or extermination camps.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's whenever we look back at history, you know, we always see that the propaganda that comes out of it is very much still part of the oppression that was happening, you know, during World War II. So when we move from concentration camp to internment camp, or we say concentration camp when we really mean a death camp, it just allows us to constantly whitewash history. And that's just not helpful in terms of breaking down oppression and doing what we say never again. That's often something that's said in the Japanese American community when we're trying to speak out about these camps, is the reason is never again. So it's about moving away from euphemisms in order for us as a society to really confront our history in a way that is realistic.
And another euphemism was the evacuation or relocation, and actually not calling it what it was, which was
a forced removal. Forced removal of citizens and of residents and people who were being forcefully removed from their homes simply because of, well, what their last name sounded like.
And it's actually something that's coming back now, or has been coming back in the last few years, which was, you know, what we call detention camps for, you know, immigrants and refugees who are just trying to flee a terrible situation and come into the United States. A couple of camps have been kind of repurposed.
Mm-hmm.
And I read about two of them, Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and there's one in Texas as well.
Yeah, these were locations that have held multiple communities over, you know, a few centuries now, where Fort Sill specifically, when it was built in the 1800s, first housed Native Americans. And then later, you know, it was used to imprison Japanese Americans. And then now we see people who are asylum seekers and refugees being imprisoned there as well. And so that's the scary thing, is that we see the camps often being used, and then they just get repurposed over and over and over again. And we don't remove these camps. And you know, when we say camp, too, it's not a camp, it's a prison, you know. And that's me being stuck in that euphemism and being stuck in that propaganda that constantly gets put out, so that it you know, lessens the blow of what is actually going on. And, you know, we see these pictures of what is happening. We are seeing children in cages, and they're prisons. That's what they're being locked up in prisons. And so, you know, it's important for us to realize that even though we want to be saying never again, our government actually makes it very easy for it to happen again and again and again.
If you just joined us, I'm Dimae Roberts, stage and studio, and I'm on location at Oregon Children's Theater. My guests are actress and Kabu's interim co-station manager, Jenna Yokoyama, and Ken Yashikawa, who is a poet and an actor. And we're going to talk more about Ken's poetry soon, but I also want to talk about the activism part of the Japanese-American community here. There's one particular project right now, that Tsuro.
Are you talking about Tsuro for Solidarity?
Oh, so there's one particular project right now that you're actively involved in, which is basically involves making how many different cranes right now?
Well, nationally, it's a national movement, Tsuro for Solidarity, and we're trying to fold 125,000 cranes. And the 125,000 origami cranes are meant to represent the 125,000 Japanese Americans that were incarcerated during World War II. And, you know, you had mentioned Fort Sill, and that's actually where it kind of started, where, you know, people were wanting to protest what we saw, that, you know, this incarceration of children and families and the separation of children and families at the border. So this movement grew and grew and has become a national movement. We have a little chapter here in Oregon, and we actually have a local goal of folding 25,000 cranes. It actually started as 10,000, and we managed to meet the goal very, very quickly because we see a lot of support coming from the Japanese American community as they're wanting to show support and to speak out against what is currently happening in a place that their family and you know, our whole community was incarcerated in.
How is the local branch, I guess, of this national project going?
Oh, it's going. It's an interesting thing to see, because here in Portland, the Japanese American community is actually very small in, compared to, say, like Seattle or Los Angeles. But we are a very tight community in terms of speaking out and carrying forward these conversations. So we've actually got quite a bit of support when it comes to people organizing their own events to speak out, people petitioning, and even people participating in planning on going to Washington, D.C., which is happening in June, because Suda for Solidarity as a national organization is organizing a march and rally to march on Washington in that first week of June in order to ask our government to pass legislation to close all of these camps. And so in order for us to not continue the cycle and in order to recognize people's humanity, that we shouldn't be putting children and families in cages and individuals in cages when what they're doing is trying to seek asylum and trying to seek safety.
I have a great respect for Japanese Americans who are activists because they're very tied to when something happens, like what's happening on the border, or after 9/11 when South Asians and Middle Eastern Americans were being persecuted. And it seems like the Japanese American activism community has been very responsive.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes I think that that's a reaction off of our community not being allowed to be active for many years. You know, coming right out of World War II, there were all these rules passed for the Japanese American community. When you were let out of these concentration camps, you were told you were never to speak Japanese in public and you weren't supposed to congregate with other Japanese people. And as a community, we sort of fell into silence where there was a lot of trauma coming out of the camps. So people just wanted to move on with their lives and rebuild their lives. So there was a lot of not talking about it. My grandparents were put into camps. And I actually heard very, very little about it. And I have a very typical story where I know that my family went, but the specifics of it, I don't know very much. And the stories I do hear were often very whitewashed and made to be told, oh, it was fine, it was okay. But when I really think about the reality of it, it must have been hugely traumatizing for those who went through it in my family. So now we're in what we call the Yonsei generation, the fourth generation, my generation, where I think we're kind of far enough removed from that time period where we as a generation feel like we can speak out. And I think we're very privileged in that way, where we are now a community that is not in so much fear that we're afraid to speak out. And I think we all feel a responsibility for those of us who understand the privilege it is to speak out. And so it's very encouraging to see so many people of my generation actively speaking up and being encouraged by the generation before us to speak up in a way that they weren't allowed to.
People want to get involved with folding cranes or just helping somehow with Suda for Solidarity. How do you recommend that they help out?
Oh, they can visit the website sudaforsolidarity.org. That's T-S-U-R-U for Solidarity. That's the national organization's website. And we're also on social media at Suda for Solidarity Oregon. That's how you can find out what's happening locally.
Well, this is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts with Jenna Yokoyama and Ken Yashikawa. We're all working on the play, The Journal of Ben Uchida, which opens February 29th, runs through March 22nd at the Winningstad Theater downtown. You can find out more about that at Oregon Children's Theater's website at octc.org. And if you just missed any of this show, you can hear it again at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio. So, Ken, you recently published a book, and it's called Monster Colored Glasses. What does the title refer to?
Well, the book Monster Colored Glasses, if you look at the cover, there's a pair of glasses on the beach, and they're colored red, and in the frames are these monsters, and in the background is this very pretty beach. And for me, what it means, Monster Colored Glasses, is the way that fear and trauma affects people and therefore the way we perceive others in the world and ourselves after having experienced trauma. And this goes for both the victims of trauma and also then eventually the perpetrators of trauma and abuse. For instance, if we were to consider the World War II, then I imagine that not only were the white supremacist thinkers of people like the American Legion and all such like that probably deeply affected by their racism, which had its roots in fear, but also the victims, the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in concentration camps, then came out with Monster Color Glasses 2, which we can even see now with television shows like Terror and things like that, which are extraordinary. And yeah, and also how personal experiences of trauma, not necessarily on such a grand scale, but, you know, anything from one-on-one abuse to who knows what, there are elements of abuse in this book as well. And this book is divided into three parts. The first part chronicles the story of my rearing and then me meeting this mentor figure who was very abusive. And then the second part is about the processing of that trauma, and the third is about returning to vulnerability and softness again. So yeah, the Monster Color Glasses, we wounded, we experience fear, and we put them on maybe to feel safe, to feel that we need to run away into that. And there's poems that describe that process in this book, and then eventually we realize that we're wearing them, and then we take them off, hopefully.
How many poems do you have in the book?
I believe it's 32. There's the postscript and the preface both are a poem, and I don't think they're necessarily numbered, so I think it's 32, yeah.
And how long was this process of writing them and then coming to fruition in your first publication?
Well, okay, so I began writing these poems probably in 2014 when I came back to Portland in intent to do theater, and whenever I wasn't doing a play, I would just create my own material and perform it at a spoken word or a slam. And then about a year and a bit ago, I met an individual named Igor Brezhnev, who is the founder of Lightship Press, the press that has published this book. And it was at a house show for Slamlandia, and we just, you know, hit it off in a really cool way, and he was interested in my work, and then we built a friendship, and then eventually collaborated, and I found other collaborators like Connor Choi, my illustrator, and as well as Sam Preminger, who is the editor of the book, and pulled this thing together. It took about a year from conception to finish.
Do you have a selection that you'd like to read from Monster Colored Glasses?
I do. The thing about this book is a bilingual book. It has an interesting relationship with the Japanese language. But this is a poem that I believe reflects and connects to the Journal of Ben Uchida, because it involves the supposition of what would it be like if my Japanese grandmother was incarcerated in America, because she wasn't. The key is that I don't actually have any family, Japanese family, who were incarcerated in America, because my Japanese family all still do live in Japan. And I am a new wave first generation, but you can also call me a third culture kid, as someone who was raised abroad and out of the cultures that I technically, you know, belong to. So this is a poem called National Disaster. I wonder what I would ask my Japanese grandma, my oba-chan, if she were here, having been an American citizen 76 years ago. She wasn't. She was in Japan. But I wonder how different she would be if she spoke English. I guess she wouldn't speak Japanese, so neither would I. I don't like that. But I think I'd ask her, and maybe only once, what did they take? Not why did they take it, we already know that, but what? What toys did you play with? What color was your blanket? And even if she knew English with an MA in education, I don't think she'd open up. It's already like that with us. When I call her, not much is said except whether I'm genki, ganbatteru, and eating enough. So I wonder, because I can, what if her mother, my great-grandma, my hibachan, had the perfect rolling mat for makizushi, and that with it she could steamroll the whole neighborhood, all the houses and the four-door Fords and Studebakers. There'd be hydrants bundled with knives, pomade, pastel fences, and salmon. I bet she could make sushi with the moving train. It'd be spinning in a loop inside, I bet. I bet she could roll this land from coast to coast. Oregon roll, California roll, Rocky Mountain roll, you're not in Kansas any roll, welcome to Tule Lake roll, Minidoka roll, the Broll of Rights, the Decla roll of Independence, the Statue of Rollbirdie, Mount Rollshmore, Rollis Island, Pearl Harbor. I imagine she would say yes. In fact, because she and her mother were such secret Asians, had such a role in the war effort against the United States of America, that that sushi roller was exactly what they took from them, as well they should. Because it's clear, my hibachan, feeding her babies, could prove to be a national disaster.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
You enjoy reading.
I really do. It's my life's one of my life's passions. I like writing and I like sharing it with people. Thank you.
You want to do another one?
I do. I do. I'll do a short one about it's at the very end of the book.
You have this one memorized?
I do.
Oh, okay. I better be prepared.
Yeah, so...
performance mode here.
I know. Thank you. Yeah, the cool thing about the Japanese is that at the beginning of the book, it's more accessible. But at the end of the book, the Japanese just stands on its own and is utterly inaccessible to anyone who may not understand, unless they do the work, you know. This is called Quiver. Quiver. For the moonlight in your palm lines, a library of star signs. A chamber full of salt remembers each kindness, while true faults make maps for lost pilots who forgot how to stop. Not to hear and respond, but to listen and bond, that there's less at the top, but more in the silence. Take good note and file it, but more than just save it, to savor the feedback as lilacs to ley lines, aligned by the facts, hold back what reacts. When loss becomes labor, charm demons with violets to vapor. No matter what's happened, remember, there's still air here. No hope is vanity once put to action. Even if it's breathing, the physics remains the same in any language. Yumemi yumiya, aijō yokeru na. Kyō no kagami no game no gaman yori kūki no amasa ni awase. Yabuttemo yoroshii, kimi ga jūbun. Miro, yama no yoko ni aru 200 no kumogami. So let it. I'm talking in my sleep because my heart speaks Japanese and I believe in you, like I believe in gravity, which means I don't understand, but I know you're there to watch my step, though I may still fall, but your soft eyes accelerate, no problem at all, and I wake right next to you with the quiver full of moonlight. And my gratitude, arigatai, good morning.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Wow. Yeah. It's performance, but it's also your own words, so it just means a lot. So how can people get a copy of your book?
Well, you can get it at my website at yoshikawaken.com, YOSHIKAWAKEN.com. Or you can get it at Powell's Books on Burnside downtown. And you go to the blue section, and it's right by the door. You just got to look down a little bit. Monster Color Glasses. It's a blue book with orange lenses. So it'll be staring right up at you.
Everybody asks for Monster Color Glasses at Powell's, right? So before we go, I actually wanted to ask Jenna, because it's been, you know, I took a big long break before getting back into acting, like 14 years, but I think it's been almost as long for you as well since you have had a role acting, right?
Yeah, I did a production last year, but before that, it had been well over a decade since I had been on stage. And for that, I was doing, you know, like opera musical theater stuff. So doing even just like a play, it had been probably closer to like 15 years.
Yeah, you were in Gambatte last year.
Yeah.
But what is it like to be, you know, back in the swing of things? It seems like you're picking it up naturally, right? It just comes back to you.
It always feels like home to be in a theater and to be on stage. And so to come back to it makes me realize how much I missed it. Because, you know, when you kind of go away from it, you're like, oh, okay. And then you're busy doing other things in life. And then when you come back to it, you're like, oh, why did I ever leave this? So I'm glad to have the opportunity, and especially to come back to theater in order to specifically tell the stories from my community is something that is so incredibly special. And I think for a while I was kind of with theater, whatever. But then when I was approached with this opportunity to tell my community's story, it suddenly was very, very appealing to come back to stage, because that's kind of why I had left it the time ago before. It was just like, well, all the roles I were getting were in a cringy way. I was generically Asian, and I was very much always being very typecast, and I was uncomfortable. And so to come back and then to play a Japanese American, that was the first time I had ever done that. It was a completely different experience. And so, and then even in this play, it's something new too, and getting to kind of tell this story from a different perspective. And yeah, so, you know, people want to keep putting me in Japanese American show, sure, why not? I mean, it's something that is unlike anything else to tell the story of your community.
It really is something special to be able to do your own culture, mm-hmm. you know? So you're both fabulous to work with. So I will give more information about that later. But I just want to say that it's been great talking to you, Jenna Yokoyama, and to work with you and Ken Yoshikawa.
Thank you.
And yeah, so yeah. Well, so if you want to see the Journal of Ben Uchida, it's February 29th through March 22nd at Oregon Children's Theater, and go to their website at octc.org. Before we go today, I want to remember the recent passing of two extraordinary artists and activists in our community. Valerie Otani was one of the founders of Portland Taiko, where she performed with them for 25 years as a longtime company member. Valerie's art installations and public art projects often focused on Japanese American incarceration history. She was also instrumental in the development of the Oregon Nikkei Endowment. Most recently, Valerie Otani established the Hillsboro Public Arts Program, where she worked as the supervisor until her retirement last December. She leaves behind a legacy of work and activism that will be long remembered. A service will be planned in the coming months, and info will be posted at portlandtaiko.org. We also lost another artistic light, Kathy Coleman, artistic director and founder of Disability Art and Culture Project. She conceived of the Disability Art and Culture Project not only as a way to support movement arts, but also a way to foster affirmative disability identity in individuals and the community. A memorial for Kathy Coleman will be in the coming weeks. It will be posted on dacphome.org. That's it for Stage and Studio today. Thanks for listening. Hear the show again on stageandstudio.org or kboo.fm/stageandstudio. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and like us on facebook.com/stage_n_studio or tweet me at @stage_n_studio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts. We're going out with more music by Dave Iwataki. Thank you.
in places like Sri Lanka, where some elephants are free to roam around the edge of the ocean, that just for the pure joy of it, they jump into the sea and they use their trunks as snorkel. And they can go 20 to 30 miles just for the pleasure of it all.
You were just listening to Ingrid Newkirk, founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or as most of us know it, PETA. You can hear the rest of her interview with me on Voices for the Animals on Friday, February 28th, 10 a.m. right here on KBOO. Or go to kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals to listen online.
I can't stay here any longer, 'cause my sweet love ain't around.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Robin and Linda Williams. With a rich career spanning over four decades, the duo have made it their mission to perform the music they love, a blend of bluegrass, folk, old-time, and acoustic country. Robin and Linda sang Americana before it was cool. The show is Friday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO. Up next on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews installation artist Yoon-Hee Choi about her installation, Wythe, on now at Front House Gallery.
Andy Wawo looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Wawo, silver stream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Yoon-Hee Choi. She is a sculptor and installation artist, and her piece, With, is on now at Front of House Gallery at 112 Southwest 1st Street. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Yoon-Hee.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you are known, I've known you as an artist at Blackfish, but you've got this space in, what's the name of the architecture company?
Jessica Helgerson, Interior Design.
Mm-hmm. So it's this space where you think you're going to someone's office, but the front of house, uh-huh. As soon as you come in the door, is an art gallery. And they always have something.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And you have taken this space and reacted to the space and made, there's a sculpture in